Today's guest says that while stress can be managed, mood can be elevated, growth can be arrested, blood can be stalled, and a clock can be busted, memory cannot be retrieved with a single magic bullet. Indeed, in Alzheimer's disease, the medical world is facing its hardest hour. Hello, everyone. I'm Pamela Brewer, and I'm delighted to have you join me on this edition of Mind Talk. And I'm very pleased to introduce to you Dr. Shuvendu Sen. Dr. Sen is a renowned physician, author, speaker, and humanitarian. He is the Director of Medical Education and Associate Director of the Internal Medicine Residency Program at Raritan Bay Medical Center at Hackensack University. Dr. Sen is the author of numerous medical and scientific publications, books, chapters. My goodness, Dr. Sen, you are quite a busy individual.
I try to. I mean, all these things are so linked with each other. I mean, I, of course, take care of patients, but I also, like to write. It takes me to places where medicine fails to reach.
Well, today we're going to be focusing on some of your writing. In fact, we're going to be focusing on a book that you have written entitled Why Buddha Never Had Alzheimer's, a holistic treatment approach through meditation, yoga, and the arts. Tell me about the reason for writing this particular book. There's so much that is written about Alzheimer's. Your book is so hopeful, though, and so helpful. Why write this book?
I guess it has a couple of reasons. One was, it's a very personal reason. I mean, my grandmother, she suffered from Alzheimer's, and I'm talking about good many years back when we did not have any comprehension at all about the length and breadth of this disease. What struck me was the fact that she was an out-and-out scholar, very educated, very erudite, very academic. Back in those days, she was highly respected as an author. So it struck me, and I was very young, I was in grade six, it really struck me that someone who's so educated, someone who uses the brain so regularly, would become a vegetable overnight. And she probably had the slender signs and symptoms which all escaped our attention. But nonetheless, she escaped all our attention one evening, and we lost her. We lost her for about 48 hours. So when we eventually rescued her and she came back, she had no recognition of herself or any realization of where she belonged, and she just turned into a functional ruin. And it struck me that someone who is so educated, so academic, so scholarly, how can she turn into a vegetable? Now, 30, 40 years down the road, we are facing the same question. Because, you know, it's a myth when we say that if you're educated, if you're academic, you're not going to get the Alzheimer's because you're using your brain. But Alzheimer's is much more than that. So that was one, you know, nagging point that I always carried with myself years before I became a doctor. Now, after practicing medicine, joining medicine, if I may use the word mainstream medicine, I realized that we are literally scratching the surface. We got about 2 to 3 FDA-approved drugs, appropriately approved by FDA, but then the longer trials clearly show that they are not curative at all. At the same time, we have this vast treasure of meditation, of yoga, something that was and has been used for centuries. And now that we are blessed with modern technology, we are actually now researching into the brains of these meditators, and we are actually finding, lo and behold, that they are showing the benefits of this meditation on those areas of the brain which are getting hit by Alzheimer's. So it was almost like a compelling force, and I thought of bringing it up to the forefront.
Well, it certainly is, as I said a moment ago, a different approach to thinking about and Alzheimer's and treatment. But let me ask you, let me go back a bit. You were six years old when grandmother went from being one person to a completely different person. Do you recall what that was like for you just as a little one? I would think that'd be pretty scary and pretty confusing.
I was emotionally crushed because I was her favorite. And there were a lot of conversations back and forth, a lot of stories that were told. And she would listen to everything that I would say, some that made sense, some that did not make sense. So for me, it was a shock because it was the collapse of a relationship. I mean, I can understand that, you know, she would come down with a disease because she was on the senior side, and I can accept that. But to look at someone who had complete structural integrity, and there was nothing wrong structurally, but that a person who looked the same just did not behave the same way, and it completely shocked me. It left a very deep impact on me. And now that I practice medicine and I see the same effects on the caregivers when they take care of their beloved, and there's no as such structural disease that they can hold on to. It is just the collapse of a relationship, despite having the presence of the beloved. So it's a disease with enormous emotional impact, and I felt it at a very young age, and I carry it with me even today.
You know, it speaks to the importance, I would suggest, of reminding ourselves as adults that children have feelings, they are connected, they have relationships, and I just wonder how many adults will choose to say very little, if anything, to a child, particularly a young child, not knowing what to say to the child or assuming the child doesn't notice or won't remember, when in fact this was a significant relationship for you, even at six, and it is one that has stayed with you for your lifetime.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you know, I carry it with me, and a lot of my primary emotions have been dictated with a love that was lost overnight. Mm-hmm. You know, as it happens when you're at that age, you get the undivided attention of your grandparents because your parents are busy and the world outside is very busy. And that was my little privacy. That was my little world where I interacted with fearless respect or disrespect. You know, I could do whatever I wanted to. I could say, I could relate to her in whatever ways. And that sudden collapse, this almost the vanishing of a relationship, the suddenness of it all. It's almost, I felt like somebody just grabbed my grandmother and pulled her into the darkness, and I couldn't see her. And then the agony of seeing her in reality and trying to go back to the intimate moments that I had with her and failing repeatedly when she would just stare at me or just cry for no reason. And so that left a very deep impact on me. I had no comprehension of it. Now, as I age, I realize, you know, what a terrible agony it was.
For you and for her.
And for her. You're so right, for her. For her, it is unpublished. I mean, I wouldn't know how she would feel. So it's a very different disease, you know. And when I talk to the caregivers, for me, it becomes, in a very negative way, I become very nostalgic because I see the same emotions coming. I see the same, I don't know what to do kind of a feeling where caregivers are completely shattered with this new relationship of someone with whom they cannot relate and with whom they had related for years and years.
Who's there but not really.
And yes, exactly. Devastating disease. Both for the sufferer as for the others, the caregivers.
Just the word, the term Alzheimer's disease sends, I think, people young and old into this sort of terrified I hope this doesn't happen to me. Is this happening to me? You know, 18 years old, you've misplaced your keys. Oh my goodness, I have Alzheimer's. It truly is a disease that frightens so many people. Is the fright, is the worry about it well-founded?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, it's not the first time that we clinicians and scientists we have come across a disease with such colossal effect. We had it in the past. I mean, we had infectious diseases like, let's say, the Spanish flu. We had the plague. We had leprosy. And then in recent years, we had HIV. And so those were major diseases. They quickly spilled out of classrooms. They became social affairs. But, you know, we could quickly come to the root of the cause. And every time we got challenged, we hurled defiances. But with this disease, it is a completely different battle. Simply because, and I don't mean to sound superficial, but it is comparatively easier to address problems of a liver, problems of a spleen, problems of a colon, problems of a bone, as compared to the complexity of a brain. As also the fact that the mind is much more than the brain. Just as I don't know where my bathroom is not Alzheimer's. Alzheimer's is much more than that. So this complete fright is very well founded, because we really do not have a clue who's going to get it, and even the pace of the disease. You know, that the very early stage of this disease, we call it MCI, like mild cognitive impairment. Now, from MCI to a full-blown Alzheimer's is anybody's game. You could remain an MCI for the rest of your life, which is a good thing. You could go very slowly to Alzheimer's, which is also probably better if you take 30, 40 years to reach there. But it could be also fast and furious. I mean, I have an example of someone who's tragically a doctor. She was a brilliant doctor, and then she got hit with Alzheimer's. And again, she probably harbored those hushed signs and symptoms, but then it escaped the attention of everyone. But then the story goes like this. She was writing to her husband, and she started off by saying, "My beloved husband." After a paragraph and a half, she lost her identity, and she quickly ended with, "Your beloved daughter." So this complete change of identity all happened within in a paragraph and a half of a letter. So it can hit you that fast. So yes, you're absolutely correct. This is a frightful situation, and it is well-founded.
You say that you wonder if, as physicians, perhaps the boat has been missed, so to speak, in a rush for a diagnosis. What did you mean by that?
You know, we do not understand the pathology of this disease. More often than not, we rush to give a diagnosis. Now, it is very true in this disease, and let me explain to you why. Because, as I said, you know, Alzheimer's is much more than, oh God, I don't remember where I parked my car, or as you started by saying, that I don't remember the name of another person. I don't remember. Alzheimer's is much more than that, and you cannot, or one cannot, comprehend how we forget unless we have a full comprehension of how we remember. And this memory thing is a very deep, is a very complex thing. And again, memory is not just you're remembering who I am or I'm remembering your name. Memory is much more than that. Memory is a reflection of the change that's constantly, that we are constantly undergoing. You know, for example, meeting you is an experience, and it primes my brain, and my nerve cells, they react accordingly, and it leaves an indelible impression. Now that becomes the memory. And very soon it's going to be predictive of who I will become, because it's going to control my forward emotions, my forward hopes, my optimism, or on the negative side, if I'm pessimistic, or any fears that I have. And also, memory is a relationship. And I'll give you an example. For example, if I have your telephone number and I put it in the computer, all I have to do is to just mention your name, and the computer will bring out your telephone number. It's a very cold-hearted but a very sure kind of a response. Compare this with the fact when I am remembering your telephone number. The moment I try to remember your telephone number, I got to remember you. I got to remember your mannerism. All of these, even if it is in a flash of a second, it will come. So it's a relationship. So Alzheimer's, when we talk about Alzheimer's, you got to reverse the process. So it's not just about not knowing who you are, but it's also about losing relationships. So, you know, we tend to give 2 + 2 = 4, and we say, okay, so this is the diagnosis. And very often we miss the mark. In Alzheimer's, I think we are missing the mark because it's not like depression. It's not like bipolar disease, where it's a very uniform kind of a presentation where we know exactly what's happening. In Alzheimer's, it's hard to give a diagnosis because it can come with anything. It can come with the fact that I don't know who you are, so it's a personality, it's an identification problem. It can come with a personality problem. I can start behaving differently. It can come with finding the right words. And I've used this example many times that, you know, the gentleman who would say and be very articulate and say that, you know what, I need to have a toast, an omelet, a pancake or an orange juice for my breakfast, that gentleman starts finding difficult to get those words. So all he says, he replaces it with one word, I like to have breakfast. Now that's a perfectly legitimate word. It escapes the attention of the whole family. But then that's the beginning of the beginning. That's how Alzheimer's, one type of Alzheimer's starts, where you have problem in finding the words. So it's very hard to come with a diagnosis when the repertoire is so huge and limitless.
You know, in my practice as a mental health clinician, were I to be engaged in the insurance industry, if you will, I would be required to make a diagnosis within one visit. Is the same true if you are diagnosing something as complex as Alzheimer's? Is there an insurance industry driven perhaps need or push to come up with a diagnosis almost immediately?
You're so correct. Well, unfortunately, yes. I mean, again, I, like you, I take care of, you know, patients. I'm mainstream medicine. I prescribe medications. But then I think that there is a drive from the industry, which kind of makes it a little difficult. Difficult in the sense that we get the signs and symptoms, but we miss the patient. We get the treatment, but we miss the healing part. And we miss this patient, we miss this healing part because we are programmed to come up with a name, to come up with a diagnosis, to come up with a disease, and then to come up with a drug, which is meant for that disease. And I think we have, there was a time when we were not blessed with modern technologies, and there were a lot of opinions, but then we evolved. We became finer, and we improved upon ourselves. But I think we are taking it to the other extreme end, where all that we are doing is just going for the signs and symptoms, coming up with a diagnosis, and hitting it with a one-line prescription. And the primordial organs with which we started our practice, like our eyes, our ears, our hands on the pulse, these are completely gone. And I think we are suffering because of that. That's one of the main, I would say, Achilles heel in modern medicine.
Dr. Sen, author of Why Buddha Never Had Alzheimer's, we are going to take a break, but we will be back in just a moment.
Sure.
Dr. Sen, we've been talking about ability, the tendency to miss some of the perhaps early signs and symptoms. What are the signs and symptoms of Alzheimer's? Is there a discrete list or no?
Well, that's the biggest challenge, and that's why we keep on saying that this is, we are scratching the surface. The signs and symptoms in the very early stage are so fine, so subtle, that it's hard to actually come up with a diagnosis at such an early stage. As also the fact with Alzheimer's, it's a completely different story for us. We are literally struggling to even come up with a proper presentation, and which is why we kind of lump it together. And we say that lack of sleep could be one of the risk factors for Alzheimer's. So if you have sleeplessness, that's one. Then there are other literature saying that if you have a problem in smelling, if the olfactory areas are affected, that is also considered to be a presentation of Alzheimer's. But again, these are not considered to be diagnostic simply because with age, anybody and everybody can have an olfactory problem. Anybody and everybody can have insomnia. But we do have certain generalizations. We talk about lack of sleeplessness, as I said, sleep. We talk about seizures. Some Alzheimer's can actually present with seizures. But then you do know that seizure can present. The causes of seizures are so many that we can pinpoint a seizure patient and say, aha, that's Alzheimer's. Word finding, problem in finding the right words, that is also a very early sign. And but how do we know that? We know, and this is something that I would get in retrospection from the caregivers of my patients, that their patients would actually turn very silent. They would there's a certain amount of introspection. And they would be in their quiet corner, they are within themselves, they are watching TV, and they are not talking as much as they would be talking before. Now, we know that they are not talking not because they have suddenly decided to be all by themselves. It's just the fact, as I gave you the example of the breakfast, they were not finding the right words. And dignity is very important for these patients. So they kind of go back within themselves and just make themselves silently comfortable. That's one presentation. The other presentation is, inability to recognize someone, and personality change is another one. They can't get agitated. They get agitated because they're not finding the right words, or they are unable to do the usual things that they were very comfortable in doing. So, I had a patient who, as his wife told me, was perfectly all right, and then suddenly she found that he was unable to switch on the fan, and he was actually using a very long stick to rotate the fan blades. So, and that was actually the beginning of the beginning, and she was telling me, Dr. Sen, believe me, there was no hint prior to that. So, their presentations are very varied, and the early stages also are like extremely, extremely diverse.
When you think about the numbers of people who could potentially be impacted upon by the United States, are the numbers high, or is this something that is a relatively small portion of the population?
If you go by statistics only, the facts and figures are very horrifying. The numbers, the Alzheimer's Association and the other standard organizations, and I'm a member of them, they would actually say, 5.5 million. And the projection is terrible. The projection is in another few decades, it's going to become 20 million. And I'm talking about only United States. I haven't even crossed the ocean. But if you think about it, that there are the basic fact that Alzheimer's is not born overnight. And as we discussed a few minutes before, that so many of us could be in the very early stage of Alzheimer's when it is not even Alzheimer's. It is what we call as MCI, mild cognitive impairment. At that stage, that particular individual is actually moving around without any obvious signs and symptoms. He's driving the car. he or she is driving the car, managing his or her banking account perfectly, but probably is having that early signs that we just discussed, let's say not finding the right words. If you get those numbers, as also the fact, if you think about this recent literature that's coming up, which is very, very disturbing, that caregivers who take care of their Alzheimer's patients, whether it's the brother or the sister or the wife or the husband or anyone, the scientific literature is clearly showing that they are also becoming potential targets, that those exact areas of the brain which gets hit in an Alzheimer's patient, let's say the left hippocampus or the premedial frontal cortex, those are the areas that are found to be affected in a caregiver. So strong literature is coming out that they themselves, down the road, can come down with this disease. So if you keep that huge number, and if you add the potential Alzheimer's who are moving around with an early signs and symptoms, which could be you, which could be me, you can easily close your eyes and quadruple that number. Now you're looking at a tsunami, which is just, you know, waiting to hit us.
That is scary. That is, I mean, it almost leaves one speechless when you think about the potential impact of this illness.
Yes. And it's still so silent. It's not still not making the adequate noise as it should. And I was I had a lecture recently at the university, and I was giving statistics that how much of research funding we devote towards cancer, we devote towards HIV, and compared to that, how less we are devoting towards Alzheimer's, not realizing that there is a tsunami which is just around the corner. We are at the brink of a national, if not a global, epidemic, pandemic.
The name of your book, as you know, is Why Buddha Never Had Alzheimer's. So why is that the case?
All right. So I come from a country where meditation is like a sport. It's taught in schools, it's fostered in cultural circles, it's almost like a passion. And the benefits of the meditation are very rich. As a matter of fact, the incidences of Alzheimer's in that part of the world is much less compared to this part of the world.
Interesting.
And the reason I brought Buddha is because of the fact that this whole concept of mindfulness meditation and the various forms of meditation that followed for centuries kind of started with him. Now, the history will also say that it was there even before Buddha, because meditation was so inherent in amongst people of that part of the world. But I guess Buddha almost has become the point of entry. You know, it's become a brand name. So I wanted to bring him, and also the fact that he lived well past 80, and he died very young, in the sense that he died with a very young and an active mind. And he was the epitome of meditation. I mean, almost all the poses of Buddha is a meditative pose. And this whole concept of, you know, if I may use the word non-judgmental awareness, which is the definition of mindfulness meditation, but kind of came from him and his teachings. And this is a treasure. This is a treasure that we harbored for centuries and centuries. And as I say, we are very blessed that now we have the modern technologies. We have the functional MRIs, we have the PET scans, and we have EEG and various other sophisticated forms of diagnostic tests that we can now implement on the meditators and actually see the tremendous amount of benefits that meditation does to our brain.
There are people listening, I'm sure, who are saying, meditation. All right, so I sit still for a minute and I think about nothing, and so what? How could that possibly, that mindless thing, possibly have an impact on a disease so devastating? What do you say to those folks, those non-believers, if you will?
Right. So it's all about science. And I completely agree with their concerns. I will completely agree to their legitimate questions, because modern science, modern medicine is all about evidence-based. And evidence-based medicine means that you have a concept, you make a hypothesis from that concept, and you run an experiment, and you achieve what we call as a statistical significance. So in other words, if you have something, whether it's a drug or whether it's a process or a procedure, we got to put it under the microscope. We actually have to feel it in our palm. And then only then we should say that, yes, it's therapeutic. And I completely agree with that, which is why medicine was always at the fringe, because we did not have those research modalities with us. We did not have the benefits of functional MRIs, the PET scans, the various type of CT scans that we have. Now with all these tools, what those premier institutions in the world have done, including Harvard, Johns Hopkins, UCLA, and the ones in Europe, they have used these research tools and they have actually found the effects of meditation and yoga on the brain. Now, what are the effects? We found out through EEG that, first of all, there are certain waves in our brain, alpha waves, beta, delta, theta, and all that. The alpha waves are representative of our tranquility, peace, serenity inside us. So when they implemented EEG on meditators, they actually found that there were tremendous plethora of alpha waves in the brain, which was fantastic news for us. Why? Because one of the major risk factors, one of the major point of entry for Alzheimer's disease has been found to be stress. We are all stressed out. You know, we have peer pressure, we have financial pressure, we have professional pressure. We are constantly stressed out. And the literature is very clear on the fact that stress, if not controlled or governed or taken care of, can actually hit the same areas of the brain which gets hit by Alzheimer's. So this is the triumph of meditation and yoga, where by the creation of these more alpha waves, which are reflective of tranquility, we are actually bringing down the stress. Now, anyone can ask this question to me saying, why? We have a drug for stress. For example, there's a drug which you and I know. It's called Xanax. So why can't I take Xanax and get rid of my anxiety and subsequently the stress, and I should be away from Alzheimer's? But here is the problem. I have patients who come to me for a prescription of Xanax, and I'll prescribe them. But the problem is this. You start with 0.5 milligram, and they do very well, but they come back a month later and say, you know what, Dr. Sen? I have been doing very well for the first 7 days, but I think, you know, the edge is not there. I kind of have those episodes of anxiety. Can you increase the dose? And here starts the journey from 0.5 to 1 to 1.5 to 2.5. So what do you get when we increase the dose? The two bad things that happens, because in any case, no drug is an angel in the sky. The problem with Xanax is, number one, you develop tolerance, which is why you need higher dose to get the same desired effect. And number two, by the time you reach that 2.5 milligram dose, you're getting the adverse effects of Xanax. So A, the effects are blunted. B, you're getting the adverse effects, which are plenty. Here you're looking at a process, and I'm talking about meditation and yoga, which is, first of all, very cheap. It doesn't cost you anything. Number two, has absolutely no adverse effects and no tolerance effect. So that's one way. And there are many ways. That's one way how meditation, mindfulness meditation, transcendental meditation can actually, in a very scientific way, prevent a stress and from there prevent the onslaught of Alzheimer's. The other direct way, if I may continue, or if you want to say something.
Please continue.
The other very direct way is a terminology which is kind of new in the scientific fraternity. We call it neuroplasticity. Neuroplasticity means the creation of new neurons, new nerve cells. Now, neuroplasticity, when it was first proposed many decades back, people just thought this is just a figment of an imagination from scientists. But now we know that this is very true. And lo and behold, we find that meditation and yoga causes tremendous amount of neuroplasticity, tremendous amount of new neuronal connections. And again, in those exact areas of awareness, of concentration, and consciousness. So whether it is the indirect way of bringing down the stress level and hence preventing Alzheimer's, when we know that stress is a risk factor, or the direct way of implanting or introducing neuroplasticity, these are sure signs and causes for us to believe that meditation and yoga is the way to go to prevent this beast of a disease, especially at a time when we really don't have a curative drug.
It sounds like meditation should be a routine part of a prescription for anybody going to see a clinician.
You are so correct. And this is something that I have, for a good number of years, I have started implementing to my patients. And you are so right, to anyone. I'm not just thinking about Alzheimer's, thinking about any other potential disease. This is a prescription that needs to be written by all healthcare providers. And, you know, it's very interesting. While I was writing the book, I took an informal survey, very informal survey amongst doctors, all different types of doctors, because the challenge of Alzheimer's is, since we really do not know much about this disease, we are still evolving, these poor patients, they don't even know where to go. Which means they go to anyone. From a psychiatrist to a geriatrician to an internist to a neurologist to a nurse to anyone. So I took a kind of an informal survey across the board, and I asked my colleagues whether you're aware of this tremendous amount of benefits and it's research based of meditation and yoga. And 99.99 of them, they said yes, they were aware. And then I followed it up with my next question, do you implement it? And 99.99 said, no. So it's boiling down to a mindset issue. That's what I figured out. It's a mindset that I would need a drug to write, to be able to think that I'm curing the patient, rather than going back to a process, which is not as simple as swallowing a pill with a glass of water, which probably asks for a little bit of discipline. And meditation is not very complicated. I'm not telling my patients to sit in a lotus position like Buddha. You could be seated in a very comfortable corner in a chair, so long as you're not distracted, and just do the breathing, just do the non-judgmental awareness, just close your eyes. But here is the point which you correctly raised, that it is not that the scientific fraternity are not aware of, but that little journey from awareness to writing the prescription is missing.
You know, it brings up so many things that we could probably do another 3 or 4 hours just on that piece alone.
I know.
But for right now, we're going to take a break, and we are going to return. So folks, stay where you are. We'll be right back. Dr. Sen, as you were talking about the journey from writing a pill to recommending something like yoga, it reminded me of a conversation I had many years ago. I was working on a radio series about, it was like a radio soap opera, about a woman who had macular degeneration. And this was many years ago. And as I was talking to the docs about how they would share this information, some of them said that they would not even tell the patient because they couldn't do anything to make the patient better. And they had gone into medicine to make a patient better. And so I think about that, and I think about the idea that now, you know, insurance companies and society just in general, we kind of want a doctor to make things better and to make them better right now, this minute. And I just wonder how much of that impacts on the lack of full-blown embracing from the medical community with the respect with respect to the value of yoga meditation.
Right. See, it's going to be challenging. I mean, and I can see that when I look at it from a pragmatic point of view, because this relationship between a caregiver, let's say us, and a patient, for a very long period of time, now for the last this century, has been dependent on medications, on drugs. And so we are used to telling our patients that you take this drug at such and such period of time and you should be okay. And that's how drugs work. Somebody comes with a high blood pressure, I almost guarantee that patient that, you know, complications can always come, but by and large, if you take this medication, if you're compliant with those medications, you would get the desired effect in the next 7 days. So it's a very instant kind of a relationship that happens between us and a patient. And just as we are kind of tuned to this type of giving care, our patients are also tuned to receiving that type of a care. When they want to turn around and in 48 hours would want to see the desired results. When it comes to meditation and yoga, it's as I said before, the word mindset. The mindset has to change from both from our point of view as well as from a patient's point of view. And it's all about education. That for something as profound in a negative way, as Alzheimer's, which is so big, so colossal, and yet so fine, a one-line drug cannot work. We need something which is equally big, equally diverse, equally profound. And for those profound things to have its effect, it will take time. And so we are taking a completely different step here. We are talking about being a little diligent, being a little disciplined, and again, it's not hard. It's not about that you have to do it at a particular time of the day, let's say 5 o'clock in the morning. It is not time sensitive. For a nurse or for somebody like you and me, you know, time is very flexible. But it's at a time when you are comfortable. That's when you do it. But there is a discipline. There is a continuity that is required. And it is probably not as fast as just having half a glass of water and swallowing a pill. But then we also have to realize, and that's where education comes for all of us, that for a disease as huge as Alzheimer's, and maybe it's a realization point for us. Maybe this is the crossroad where we're going to take a different road when it comes to treating a patient, not just about giving advices of how to take the pill, but we also need to spend time with our patients to talk about lifestyle modifications. You know, we also talk about dietary modifications, but we don't do that often. So, you know, behavioral changes, lifestyle modifications, they can play such a huge role, not just in Alzheimer's, even in high blood pressure, in cholesterol, in diabetes. That emphasis is not there. That awareness, that stress is not there. You know, a couple of years back, we used to look into, let's say, meditation, yoga, tai chi, any relaxation techniques, any lifestyle changes as alternative medicine. Then we got a little better. We started calling it complementary medicine. Then we got even better. We now call it integrative medicine. And I have a problem with this, you know, this different terminologies that we all create. Why simply not call it medicine? Because they are all taking part in the healing of the process, the healing of that individual who's suffering. Like, for instance, when I treat high blood pressure with more than two medications, I don't say that the third medication is complementary to the first medication. We all say that all those three drugs are medications. They are all medicine. So why not accept these holistic measures as a part of medicine? You know, so it is a mindset problem. It is not going to happen overnight. You know, I've asked those fundamental questions. Why is metaphysics not physics? Why is metascience not science? Anything, to my mind, which can be proved scientifically should be considered as scientific, should be considered as mainstream medicine. So, yes, and I think, again, it's insurance-driven. There are a certain number of patients that we have to see. So we are in a day, so we are kind of rushed. And we do the easy thing. We just ask a couple of standard template questions. We get those answers. We scribble a prescription, and the patient walks out. And I don't think that's doing justice to the science. It is doing justice to the patient's suffering.
You cite a study that was done to take a look at patients who practice 12 minutes daily of yoga meditation for 8 weeks. Mm-hmm. 12 minutes for 8 weeks.
Right.
What was the result of that study?
All this while that you and I, we were discussing, the results of the study were decisive and there was no ambiguity in that study. It showed that exact those areas of the brain which are responsible for concentration, for relaxation, for awareness, those are the areas of the brain that showed remarkable improvement, and it got reflected in the behavior of these individuals who underwent these meditation. And as a matter of fact, and the good news is that the word is spreading. Although, again, you know, we clinicians, we so-called healers, we need to take it upon ourselves to you know, take this challenge to the street and involve each and every patient, as you mentioned 10, 15 minutes before, not just about Alzheimer's patient, about everyone. We need to implement this. But, you know, the word is spreading. I mean, we have U.S. Marine Corps. They underwent mindfulness meditation, and they were compared with the other group who went through the usual relaxation process. And it was found that those who underwent mindfulness meditation, they had much sharper concentration, much more awareness, much more relaxation. So, you know, the verdict is out there. It's just that we got to change the mindset. And in some cases, I think that's the hardest thing to do because we get so dogmatic. And it's almost like a defeat, you know, that I have not given the drug to cure you. And I had to go back to this ancient treasure. I don't know what the mindset is, but I think that's the biggest challenge. We just have to convince ourselves, we as healers and the community in general, that there are certain ancient treasures that have been proved to be scientific in recent years. And rather than keeping them as intellectual treasures, we just should bring them to the forefront.
You also point out in Why Buddha Never Had Alzheimer's that yoga and meditation can be helpful in a broad range of stress-related illnesses. I mean, you've talked about the impact of stress on Alzheimer's, but there's also been a look at the impact of yoga and meditation for those dealing with anxiety, post-traumatic stress disorder, depression, and even substance abuse.
Absolutely.
This is a powerful tool.
Absolutely. Yes, please.
You say that there are two types of meditation, mindfulness meditation and transcendental meditation. What's the difference?
All right. So to get back to your previous point, because it's such a tempting point that you wrote, with the post-traumatic stress disorder, if I may.
Yes.
There were some glorious examples, and I gave that case study of tsunami that happened, in the eastern part of the world, which killed so many people. And those who escaped, they suffered from tremendous amount of post-traumatic stress disorder. And so there was a program that was actually funded from United Nations where they introduced, in a very gentle way, mindfulness meditation, simple breathing techniques, and the results were tremendous. So in those situations where you're looking at mass casualties, where you're looking at mass post-traumatic stress disorder, rather than showering medications and drugs with all its adverse effects, and you do not know which drug will work in which individual because all of us are different. This is one way where, in a very global scale, in a very large scale, we can implement and get those wonderful results. To your next question, fundamental question, you know, meditation is and I always say, because I meditate, it is a very simple process, much simpler than the common notion that, oh my God, I got to start with this ritual, which was practiced centuries back in the deep forests and all that. In mindfulness meditation, you're just sitting comfortably in your own silent corner. And rather than blocking away all the thoughts, which can be counterproductive, you allow those thoughts to be inside you. But you don't judge them. You kind of let them go inside you. And if you concentrate, you just concentrate on your breathing. You breathe in and you hold it for some time and you breathe out. And then automatically, without being very harsh and without being very synthetic, very naturally, you kind of let the other thoughts just come and go. That's mindfulness meditation. It's very user-friendly. It's not going to happen in the first day. I've had patients coming back and say, you know, I'm actually more restless. And I said, this is the beginning. And it's a process. And don't force yourself to think that, oh, my God, I'm not going to think on those thoughts. Just open the window inside you. And the idea is to open up and, in a way, channelize your mind so that your consciousness expands. In transcendental meditation, it's concentration meditation. In concentration meditation, we say you can concentrate on anything. It could be an object. It could be a flame, a candle, or you could be repeating a word. In certain process of transcendental meditation, they give you a word, and you just repeat the word. Repeating the word is not being religious. You're not embracing any religion. In fact, meditation has got nothing to do with religion. It is a practice. It is a scientific practice. You just repeat the word so that you can keep your concentration on that word. If you're having difficulty in concentrating on a flame or a picture or anything, you just keep on repeating the word and the concentration will come because you are subconsciously concentrating on that word. And the idea is to channelize all your energy eventually and focus on a certain one uniform path, which eventually, as science showed, gave rise to this plethora of alpha waves and neuroplasticity.
The fact that you make reference to the fact that it's not a religion, you know, so many people, when hearing about a quote-unquote new practice or a new way of thinking or being, will say, almost a knee-jerk reaction, well, I'm not religious. I don't really believe in that. That's not what you're talking about at all. This is, as you have said, this is a scientific practice. This is a medicine that we can provide to ourselves.
You're so true. I mean, I did mention areas where meditation has been practiced by all spiritual leaders across the board. And it happened at a time when science was evolving. So the scientists of those days, they could not translate the power of these treasures into a therapeutic use, which is what is happening now. The wonderful thing that has been happening for the last 2 to 3 decades has been now that we are armed with this fantastic technologies that we have, the scientists have now decided that, okay, let me see what this process does to the brain. And sure enough, we are going into the deeper parts of the brain and we are seeing the wonderful effects that these process does. And you're right, it has got nothing to do with religion. It's a process, it's a procedure, it's an exercise. Just as we go to the gym and we work it out, this is a cognitive exercise, a mental exercise.
So again, there is a significant amount of help that we can give ourselves. And as you said, it doesn't cost money. The only thing it costs, if you will, is time. And who better to invest your time in than your own physical and mental health?
So very well said. So very well said. That's exactly what it is. I mean, we say to invest in ourselves, let's say, in reading a good book, in gardening, in going to a good place. So similarly, we say invest in yourself that 12 minutes, that 15 minutes of your day, just that 15 minutes of your day to just picking up a quiet, comfortable corner and just sit in any position that you're comfortable with. And whether you want to concentrate on an object, close your eyes and take that inward journey, or you just want to even open your eyes and do the mindfulness where you let all the thoughts come inside you, just concentrate on your breathing comfortably. And that's all that it is.
Dr. Shuvendu Sen, author of Why Buddha Never Had Alzheimer's, A Holistic Treatment Approach Through Meditation, Yoga, and the Arts. I thank you so much for spending time with us today and for bringing the value of self-care to the hopefulness in terms of dealing with the potential impact of Alzheimer's in our lives, as well as a wonderful stress reduction tool.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed talking to you.
Alrighty, and folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Again, the name of the book written by Dr. Shuvendu Sen is Why Buddha Never Had Alzheimer's, A Holistic Treatment Approach Through Meditation, Yoga, and the Arts. Mind Talk is available to you daily, and it is available to you on demand by going to myndtalk.org. Mind Talk is provided as an educational public service. It is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. I'd love to know where in the world you are as you're listening to Mind Talk today, so do send an email to me, Pamela, P-A-M-E-L-A, at mindtalk.org. That's mindtalk.org. And remember always, if it's unacceptable, it's unacceptable. You take care.